Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway, part 7, chapter 19 of the book Anna Karenina. 1 year since little Sirza has seen Anna. That's sad. Charlotte said, poor Sirza, I feel so bad for him. Swims to the mum of fish, he said, it's not that Sirza has not seen his mother for a year that is sad. What is sad is we are seeing the damage that has occurred between Constantine, because Constantine allowed Lydia too much influence and demonized Anna to the extent that Anna was denied a relationship with her son. They did not let her see him or contact him. Anna tried to maintain that connection, but through Lydia's and Constantine's interference could not. The result is a boy grieving for the mother he was denied by the father, who should have made sure that did not happen, regardless of what circumstances Anna left. I am Norwegian, said children becoming pawns during divorces is nothing new. I'm not sure what to say about Karenin. The way he's keeping Anna's son from her seems almost childish, but given that he has to admit fault to get a divorce through, I understand that he doesn't want to do that. After all, he never cheated, and his job does depend on his public reputation, though if I remember correctly, he isn't taken very seriously anymore, having little chance to progress any further in his career. Minnie Owl said, it's so sad when parents do things like that just because they can't get along with their ex-partners. Reminds me of a childhood friend who used to talk about her former mother. It is sad. Sirza is the victim in all this, and all the adults in this book are dickheads. I don't think there's any exceptions to that statement. Yep, nope, they're all dickheads. Let's read chapter 20. As was his wont, Oblonsky did not spend his time idly when in Petersburg. Besides business, his sister's divorce, and his post, it was as usual necessary for him, as he said, to refresh himself in Petersburg after the mustiness of Moscow. Moscow, despite its cafés chantants and its omnibuses, was still a stagnant pool. Oblonsky always felt this. After living in Moscow, especially in the bosom of his family, Oblonsky always felt his spirits flag. When he had spent a long time in Moscow without a break, he reached a state in which he began to be upset by his wife's ill humour and reproaches, by the health and education of the children, and the petty details of his work. Even the fact that he was in debt worried him then. But he only needed to spend some time in Petersburg among the set in which he moved, where people lived, really lived, instead of vegetating as in Moscow, and at once all the cares vanished and melted away like wax before a fire. His wife, only that day he'd been talking to the Prince Chechensky, he had a wife and a family which, with grown-up sons who were pages at court, and another family, an illegitimate one, in which there were other children. Though the first family was all right, Prince Chechensky felt happier with the second family. He took his eldest son to visit the second family and told Oblonsky that he considered it developed his son and was good for him. What would they say to that in Moscow? Children in Petersburg, children did not hinder their father's living. Children were brought up in educational establishments, and there were none of those barbaric views that were becoming so prevalent in Moscow. Lviv's was a case in point, that the children should have every luxury, and the parents nothing but work and worry. Here people understood that a man must live his own life like a civilized being. The service too, was not here that strained, hopeless drudgery that it was in Moscow. Here there was an interest in the service, meeting the right person, a service rendered, a felicitous remark. The ability to perform certain tricks made a man's career in a moment, as was the case with Bryantsov, whom Oblonsky had met the day before, and who was now a great dignitary. Service of that kind had an interest, but it was the Petersburg outlook on money matters that had a particularly soothing effect on Oblonsky. Bart Niansky, who spent at least 50,000 rubles a year at the rate he was living, had the day before made a notable remark to him on the point. As they were having a chat before dinner, Oblonsky had said to Bartnetsky, "You are, I think, intimate with Mordvinsky. You could do me a good turn if you would put in a word for me. There is a post I should like to get, member of the agency. Never mind the name, I shouldn't remember it. But why do you want to mix in those railway concerns with Jews? Look at it how you are. Look at it how you like. It's horrid." Oblonsky did not tell him that it was a live business. Bartnetsky would not have understood that. "I'm hard up, have nothing to live on." "But you do live." "Yes, but in debt." "Really? Is it much?" asked Bartnetsky sympathetically. "Very much, about 20,000 rubles." Bartnetsky burst into merry laughter. "Oh, you lucky fellow," he cried. "My debts amount to 1.5 million, and I have nothing. But as you see, I still find it possible to live." Oblonsky knew this to be true, not only from hearsay, but from actual fact. Zivakov, whose debts amounted to 300,000 rubles, didn't possess a penny, and yet he lived, and how he lived. Count Krivstov, whose case had long been considered hopeless, still kept two mistresses. Petrovsky, who ran through 5 millions, continued living in just the same style and even directed the finance department and received a salary of 20,000. But apart from that, Petersburg acted pleasantly on Oblonsky physically. It made him younger. In Moscow, he sometimes noticed some grey hairs, fell asleep after dinner, stretched himself, walked slowly upstairs, breathed heavily, felt dull among young women, and did not dance at balls. In Petersburg, he always felt that he had shaken off 10 years. In Petersburg, he felt that the 60-year-old Prince Peter Oblonsky, who had just returned from abroad, had described to him only the day before. "Here we don't know how to live," Peter Oblonsky had said. "Would you believe it? I spent the summer in Baden and really felt quite like a young man. I see a young woman, and my fancy, I dine, drink a little, and feel strong and full of spirits. I returned to Russia and had to be with my wife, and in the country besides, and in a fortnight I took to a dressing gown and gave up dressing for dinner. And as to thinking about young women, why, I had turned into quite an old man. There was nothing left for me but to think of saving my soul. Then I went to Paris and again recovered." Stephen experienced just the same difference as Peter Oblonsky. In Moscow, he let himself go to such an extent that had he continued to live there long, he might have come to a soul-saving stage. But in Petersburg, he again felt quite a smart fellow. Between the Princess Betsy Tvetskaya and Oblonsky, there existed long-established and very peculiar relations. Oblonsky, in fun, always paid court to her and told her the most indecent things also in fun, knowing that she liked that more than anything. The day after his interview with Karenin, Oblonsky, calling on her, felt so youthful that he went accidentally to such lengths in the bantering courtship and humbug that he did not know how to get out of it, for unfortunately she was not merely unattractive but actually repulsive to him. This tone had sprung up between them because he was very attractive to her. So he had been very pleased when the Princess Miagetskaya turned up and put an end to their tete-a-tete. "Ah, so you're here," she said on seeing him. "Well, how is your poor sister? Don't look at me like that," she added. "Since everyone has been attacking her, all those who are 100 times more worse than she, I have thought she has acted splendidly. I can't forgive Vronsky for not letting me know when she was in Petersburg. I would have gone to her and with her everywhere. Please give her my love." "Well, tell me about her." "Yes, her situation is a hard one," Oblonsky began, in the simplicity of his heart, taking the Princess Maya Gakaya's words for genuine coin when he said, "Tell me about her." But the Princess Maya Gakaya immediately interrupted him, as was her habit, and commenced telling her own tale. "She has done what everybody except myself does secretly, and she would not deceive, and has acted splendidly. And the best thing she did was to leave that half-witted brother-in-law of yours. Excuse me, everyone used to say, he is so clever, so clever. I alone said that he was stupid. Now that he has got so chummy with Lydia Ivanovna and Landau, everyone says he is half-witted, and I should be glad to not to agree with everybody. But this time I can't help it." "But do explain to me what it means," said Oblonsky. "Yesterday I called on him about my sister's affair and asked him for a definite answer. He did not give me an answer, but said he must think it over, and this morning, instead of an answer, I have received an invitation for this evening to go to the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's. Now, that's it, Princess Myagaya began joyfully. They will ask Landau and see what he says. Ask Landau? Why, who is Landau? What? You don't know Jules Landau, le fameux Jules Landau, le clairvoyant? The famous Jules Landau, the clairvoyant. He also is half-witted, but your sister's fate depends on him. See what comes of living in the provinces. You know nothing. Landau, you see him, was a commis, shop assistant, in Paris, and went to see a doctor. He fell asleep in the doctor's waiting room, and while asleep began giving advice to all the patients, and very strange advice, too. Afterwards, Yuri Maladinsky's wife, the invalid's wife, you know, heard of that Landau, and took him to see her husband. He is treating her husband. No good has been done, in my opinion, for he is still just as weak, but they believe in him, and take him about with them. So they brought him to Russia. Here, everyone rushed at him, and he began treating everybody. He cured the Countess Bezubova, and she took such a fancy to him that she adopted him. Adopted? How? Simply adopted him. He is now no longer Landau, but Count Bezubov. However, that's not to the point, but Lydia, I'm very fond of her. But her head is not screwed on right, naturally, has rushed at this Landau, and now nothing is settled, either by her or by Karenin, without him. So your sister's fate is now in the hands of this Landau, alias Count Bezubov. Alrighty, there we go, another chapter done. Have your say about this at the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.